Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
It's the Brian Lehrer Show on WNYC. Hello again, everybody, and it's good to be back from vacation. Tell you more about the trip on another occasion. Talked a little bit about it last hour. Binging on baseball and spring training baseball and nature in Florida over the last week on New York City Public School spring break with my wife and my son. And on this morning after Easter Sunday, progressive pastor Jim Wallace is with us. President of Sojourners, described in the New York Times as a spiritual advisor to President Obama. And he's got a new book called On God's Side, What Religion Forgets and Politics Hasn't Learned. Among other things, we'll find out why he's okay with gay marriage, but thinks heteros need to take the institution more seriously. We'll also get this liberal evangelical's take on poverty and the new pope, and I even think opening day of the baseball season might come up in our conversation. Pastor Wallace, welcome back to WNYC.
It's great to be here. Opening day, of course, it's opening the book tour, but I'm a Little League baseball coach. So for me, this is a big day for baseball's opening day. So two opening days for me.
And we'll get back to that in a little bit. I'll tell you a little bit about tickets for if you haven't done this yet with your kids. The spring training tour. Tickets for under $30. You sit right there, and we'll
I've heard the stories. I want to hear more.
We'll come back to it because I think it kind of fits with your spiritual relationship to the game. But first, so people understand the term, what does it mean that you get referred to in the press as a spiritual advisor to President Obama? That's near the top of your Wikipedia page. The Times has said it that way. What's your relationship with the president?
I knew the president back when he was a state senator in Illinois a long time ago. He gave me a copy of the Dreams of My Father book and said, nobody will ever read this, but I wanted you to have a copy. First edition a long time ago.
Little did he know.
And when he came in, I said, you know, we're old friends, but I'm going to be pushing on issues like poverty and immigration. And so I hope that's good advice, But I couldn't be his chaplain or his – so that there are other people who I think give him good spiritual counsel. But I was in a meeting on immigration with him just a few weeks ago and budget stuff. So I'm pressing all the time. And I think he's showing more and more leadership on the questions that I care about. And we're having a better and better conversation about those questions, like immigration and like poverty.
What would you say you and he have spoken about most deeply – and that he has reflected upon to you most deeply and maybe with some, you know, conflictedness in his soul?
You know, for years we had three conversations over and over again. One was he'd become a Christian. It was an adult conversion to Christian faith. He wasn't raised in it. And he said, I'm a Christian, but I'm not part of this religious right. I guess a progressive Christian like you. What is that? What does that feel like, look like? He cared about faith and social justice. Second conversation was about how he thought the categories of left and right were inhibiting, were blocking, were preventing us from finding solutions. So he felt that a long time ago. Third conversation was about being older dads with young kids. I'm older than him, but we both have younger kids, and we talked about parenting a lot. So those were our three conversations. The latest conversation was about 2 weeks ago on immigration. 12 interfaith leaders met with him in the White House for over an hour. And he talked about how this is such a high priority for him. And, of course, it is very high for us, too.
Can you say on what he seeks the most guidance? I mean, he has to make decisions on everything from how to cut Medicare for the elderly to fix the deficit to who to put on his kill list to order drone strikes against. You know, it's a heck of a job being president, as I don't have to tell you, from a moral challenge standpoint. Mm-hmm. Where have you sensed that he struggles the most with right and wrong?
Do you know, at the prayer breakfast speech he gave this year, it's worth people taking a look at. It was very kind of a low-key speech. He talked about the necessity for humility politically, as political leaders, which you don't often hear from politicians. And he says, this job he has, the White House job, it drives you to your knees. Now, a lot of people can say that, but in his case, it really has. I think it's driven him to his knees. I think he's a praying president more than perhaps he was before. And I think the notion of courage on the one hand, but humility on the other, at a deeper level. Now he's also struggling with, like in the immigration conversation, this is politics, he said, but you've raised from the faith community, you've raised the moral issue, the moral agenda. So he's trying to figure out what the moral agenda is as he's trying to figure out the political policy choices that he has to make.
Reverend Jim Wallace, my guest on WNYC. His new book is On God's Side, What Religion Forgets and Politics Hasn't Learned About Serving the Common Good. And in the book, you write that all the debate on gay marriage these days is distracting attention from what you consider a greater challenge, that marriage as an institution is weakening. Tell us what you're seeing and why it concerns you.
Well, I think we're losing marriage. Marriage is in serious trouble, particularly among low-income people, but all across the board. And when, you know, I've lived in poor neighborhoods most of my life, and literally most of the kids in my neighborhoods have never been to a wedding in their lives. And some of them have never been to a home where there was a mom and a dad. And so across the board, I think we're losing that sense of a committed, covenantal, permanent relationship. So I'd like to see there be common ground on this question. Liberals and conservatives could say together, let's reestablish, restore, recovenant ourselves to this commitment of marriage. And then, I think, find a way for same-sex couples to participate in the benefits of that. This is changing quickly. Young people are changing it. It's person to person, relationship to relationship, family to family. But I think the common ground here could be really let's restore and recommit to marriage. And the reason that heterosexual marriage is failing is not because of same-sex couples. It's because of heterosexual dysfunction and the economy and incarcerated men in poor communities and all kinds of other factors. I'd rather look at what's preventing us from reweaving those bonds of marriage, family, and parenting. And I want to then include same-sex couples in those benefits.
And as you mentioned, this is a class and socioeconomic issue.
Sure.
To a large degree. More affluent people are getting married and
yes.
having fewer kids. Less affluent people are having kids but not getting married.
Mm-hmm.
But why do you think, and I guess you just listed a few of the factors, so what can really be done to save marriage if that's your goal, if it isn't working for as many Americans as it did in the past? I imagine a more conservative minister would just preach marriage as virtue in maybe a more scolding way. But you as a progressive must be asking, why is this institution failing? Why isn't it working for real people in their real lives? Because if people, especially people with children, aren't having kids, it must be because the institution of marriage is not working for them on some level.
What's interesting is even in those conservative places that you just mentioned, the divorce rate is as high among conservative evangelicals, Southern Baptists and the rest, as it is among anybody else. So I think part of it is trying to not so much scold, but to teach and pastor and support, marriage, pre-marriage, getting people ready for marriage, and then what it takes to sustain. I love my marriage and my kids. The book's dedicated to them. They're the anchors that teach me what's important and what's not every day. But marriage is hard work. It takes real commitment. But then there are socioeconomic factors. Our unemployment rate, our poverty rate, one of five kids are in poverty, the incarceration of men of color in low-income communities is a major factor on the marriage question. The stagnation of wages, even among the middle class. The rich are getting richer at the top, but in the middle they're not, and the poor are sliding down. So all of that presents difficulties for a committed relationship. But I think we've got to both teach it and preach it and live it by example. You know, I think parenting is so important right now. I'm a dad and Little League coach.
How old are your kids?
They're 14 and 9, so I'm still right in the middle of all this. And for me, the book is full of stories about the kids. I mean, I put my boys to bed every night because I don't want to miss the stories and the prayers, great prayers at night for my boys. But I just think parenting and reweaving those bonds could really bring liberals and conservatives together. And find that's a common ground, common good for the common ground. That's the theme of the whole book on everything.
By the way, despite your progressive reputation, from what I've read, you've been slow to evolve the word people are using these days on gay marriage. I read a 2004 quote by you that you had not and would not, as of that time, perform a gay marriage, and that the Bible is never gender neutral when it comes to marriage. Are you in the same place today as you were then?
I want to say that a younger generation of Christians has really led on this, and my staff is full of them, and I give them the credit for that. There's some new biblical work coming out now that our Sojourn magazine has an article on this month, how serious biblical scholars are saying the issue is more complicated than they thought it was before. And I think that's important. I've always been strongly in favor of equal protection under the law. That's always been our position. Question is, what does that mean? And what that means is now evolving democratically. 62% of young evangelicals are in favor of marriage equality. So I think there's a movement here. But equal protection under the law was always our commitment and should be, no matter what your theology is. That should be this is a civic commitment, not something the churches should dictate or impose or control. And I think there ought to be religious freedom for churches to believe and practice the way they think best. But as a civic commitment, I think you've got to provide people equal protection under the law, and that's becoming marriage equality.
Now, listeners, call in for Jim Wallace, president of Sojourner, spiritual advisor to President Obama, author of On God's Side, 212-433-WNYC. We've got some very rich topics on the table here already for you to weigh in on or ask about. Why do you think marriage among heterosexuals in particular is weakening as an institution, even as it is the holy grail for gay civil rights? 212-433-WNYC, 212-433-9692. Do you think the religious culture wars, folks, are ending in the United States today? 212-433-9692. How do you see the mix of social and personal responsibility in fighting poverty? Can the religious right and the religious left find common ground on that today, as Jim Wallace hopes for? 212-433-WNYC, 212-433-9692. And we'll get you into the conversation here in just a minute. I do want to make sure, before we start taking calls, that we get to the centrality of poverty as a concern of yours. You've even at times juxtaposed gay marriage against that. Why do we take up so much of our theological energy debating gay marriage one side or the other when thousands of children are dying of starvation every day? Do you think the polarized religious politics of your career and your lifetime has left poverty behind in favor of hot-button sexual issues?
You just said it. The hot-button issues take the not that they aren't important, but they take all the energy and time. The Bible makes very clear that the public issue that is most central in the Scriptures is how we treat the poor and vulnerable. We in seminary did a little study. We found every verse in the Bible about the poor. Then we took a pair of scissors and we cut those verses out of the Bible. I tell the story in the book. And we were left with a Bible that was full of holes. It was falling apart. The good news is a new generation is putting their Bibles back together again. So I think when the prophets say a society is judged, finally, for its integrity by how it treats the most vulnerable, I think that's being learned now by a new generation. So I see on trafficking, on immigration, on poverty rates, on, you talked about around the world, half of God's children live on less than $2 a day, 3 billion people. So these are biblical issues, not just political ones. I think a new generation is discussed. So all through the book, I talk about how this commitment to the common good is tested. Our commitment to the common good is tested by how we treat the poorest and most vulnerable.
So let's take a call on this very point. Uh-huh. Bob in Parsippany, you're on WNYC with Reverend Jim Wallace. Hi, Bob.
Yeah, religion in this country has been a major obstacle in governmental policy and helping the poor. And, you know, I appreciate that he's speaking out on this and counseling the president, but we need to see a lot more of this in order to counteract the Southern Baptist Convention and these other evangelicals who are saying basically, hey, if you're poor, it's your fault.
Well, you know, religion can play a very negative role and a very positive role. In my book, I talk about both. Where would we be, though, without the Reverend Martin Luther King Jr. and the black churches who led the civil rights movement, or Desmond Tutu, my dear mentor and friend, in South Africa? So I think religion can pull us together or can divide us. And I think the Southern Baptists, for example, right now are supporting us on immigration reform. Richard Land and I were on the Sunday show, together on immigration reform. So it shows me we can do it. And a number of younger evangelicals care deeply about this issue of poverty. So I think the more you see what the Bible says about this, and the more that Christians actually pay attention to what Jesus said. I remember meeting in the White House, here's the president, and our team on one side of the table, his on the other, about the budget, the debt crisis. And the Catholic bishop there said, Mr. President, the text that brings us to this table does not say, as you've done to the middle class, you've done to me. It says, as you've done to the least of these. And the president said, I know that text. So that was the conversation about that text, Matthew 25, in the Roosevelt Room in the White House with the President of the United States.
And, of course, the president, as so many politicians, run on middle class, middle class, middle class, right. And they're loath to mention the poor. But to follow up on the caller's point, mm-hmm. The problem is, I think, that liberal and conservative religious people really are divided, even though you're looking for common ground on this notion of everybody forming a circle of protection around the poor, mm-hmm. which sounds great in theory. But I think liberal and conservative religious people really are divided on what that would mean, that liberals believe more in a stronger government safety net and that poverty is mostly a reflection of social conditions. Conservatives believe more in church-based safety nets and that poverty is more of a reflection of lack of personal responsibility, as the caller said. So mm-hmm. can that divide really be bridged?
I'm glad you mentioned the circle of protection, because that's a coalition now that includes both sides in that debate, like Sojourners there and Bread for the World, but also the Roman Catholic bishops. Salvation Army is there. National Association of Evangelicals is there. And we were the ones meeting in the White House with the president that day. So we would talk about church efforts being critical. You lead by example. But all of us now see that public policy is critical here. For example, all the soup kitchens, all the pantries, all the food providing services of the synagogues, the churches, the mosques, provide 6% of the nutritional needs of the country. Were it not for critical nutrition programs for working people with families and kids, they'd be in serious trouble. So how do we balance? What should the faith community do? What should business do? What should government do? We need a partnership here. And so the liberal-conservative argument about government, I do a whole chapter in the book about what the role of government ought to be, that I hope can bring us together again.
Reverend Jim Wallace will continue in a minute. His new book, On God's Side, What Religion Forgets and Politics Hasn't Learned About Serving the Common Good. We've got Edward and Woodside standing by on the dissolution of marriage as an institution. We've got Wayne in Brooklyn, who wants to know if you ever counsel President Obama on war, and a lot more to talk about with Jim Wallace. And your call is at 212-433-WNYC. Brian Lehrer on WNYC with Reverend Jim Wallace, author of On God's Side, What Religion Forgets and Politics Hasn't Learned About Serving the Common Good. Maybe you know Reverend Wallace's work from over many years as kind of a progressive religious voice, president and CEO of Sojourners. Maybe you know Sojourners and read the publication. And we're going to take your phone calls and some of the things that we've been talking about with him so far, the weakening of the institution of marriage in the heterosexual world, even as it's the holy grail for gay civil rights, religion and poverty, and some other things. 212-433-WNYC. And let's go right to another call. Is Edward in Woodside? I have your name right, Edward, right?
Yes.
Hi, thanks for calling in.
Hi. I have a question for the guest. The state of heterosexual marriage is obviously in decline or in trouble. do you believe that there's a correlation in that weakened state and the rise in the right of gay marriage being brought to the forefront?
You know, I think that the reasons that marriage, I had a debate once at Focus on the Family, you know, the very conservative think tank.
And they try to argue that there is some cause and effect there.
We had a two-hour debate with their policy people. And I said, I agree with you that the family is in trouble, that we're seeing the breakup of families. But I fail to see how gay and lesbian people are the primary ones responsible for that. After a two-hour debate, they conceded the point and said, we agree. It's more heterosexual dysfunction, they said, than gay and lesbian people. So I do think this, the answers are in the kind of our behavior and our socioeconomic situation and our lack of really committing to marriage and really raising our kids with that expectation. So I don't really think you can blame gay and lesbian people for the breakdown of the family and heterosexual marriage, even though some have tried to do that.
You're in your 60s now.
Yeah.
You've seen a lot. You've recoiled in horror when evangelical Christianity became so much about the Pat Robertson, Jerry Falwell variety, at least in the public square. Do you think that era is waning now?
I actually do think the religious right is over. Literally, their own children don't agree with them anymore. When I'd be on the road, Brian, I'd be out speaking, and late at night, young people would want to talk, and it would be literally the children of people who were leaders on the religious right, and it wasn't working for them anymore. The highly politicized, join the Republican Party, join any political party, be a sort of a block in the party, is really not the role for us. I say don't go left, don't go right, go deeper. How do we be an independent, more prophetic voice, not just in politics, but how do we live? The opening line of the book is our life together can be better. So it's how we live our lives in our communities, our households, our vocations, our workplaces, and in our public life. And I think a lot of young people want to move beyond a politicized, left and right are political categories, not religious ones. And when you squeeze it into a category, faith gets distorted.
How do you think it happened, though, historically? In the 60s, religious politics was Martin Luther King and civil rights. It was the Catholic Daniel Berrigan opposing the Vietnam War. You mentioned, of course, not in the context of this country, but Bishop Tutu.
Right.
How did it get from there to Jerry Falwell? Have you come to understand how that happened at the grassroots level? Because, again, like with marriage falling away, it must have met some kind of need among some group of Americans.
Well, there actually was a deliberate political effort and campaign by a handful of activists on the right who decided to make a deal, really, with a number of fundamentalist preachers who weren't well-known, like Jerry Falwell. And they aimed their direct mail at all these people around issues like abortion and gay rights. And they really mobilized that community. I would say a community that had really lost its proximity, by and large, to poor and vulnerable people. That's part of it, too. That's changing now. That's changing. When the president deferred deportation of 1.4 million young kids, the Dreamers, who came before they were 16, there was dancing and praising and worshiping and crying and in churches, Hispanic and Anglo, and together. So we're coming back together with the poor and vulnerable. I think that's changing our politics.
Let's take another call, and it's Wayne in Brooklyn. Wayne, you're on WNYC with Jim Wallace. Hi.
Reverend Wallace, where is your voice as the voice of Father Berrigan and Dr. King was there against war? There's a culture of death in this White House. He is dropping bombs on innocent children in Afghanistan and Pakistan with drones, with American planes. He is waging war on wolves in the Mountain West. When do you speak to him about a culture of life instead of a culture of death?
Well, we've had our disagreements with the president. Particularly, I opposed his surge in Afghanistan. I worked with a lot of the people on the ground there, and we called for a development surge and not a troop surge. So our advice wasn't listened to there. But yes, I raised those issues. I don't support our drone policy. We've spoken against and written against that policy in Sojourners for a long time. So there are differences, particularly on the foreign policy front. I think his speech in Cairo when he first came into office was some talk in the right direction, and I hope now we move in better directions. I am grateful that the two wars of occupation that we've had, he ended the one in Iraq, and the one in Afghanistan should end as soon as possible. So we're pressing him hard on ending the war in Afghanistan and, in fact, changing that drone policy. I agree with you on that.
Wayne, thank you for your call. On this idea that neither party solves problems, and there's a political right, political left, but not a religious left, religious right, or there shouldn't be, one quote from your book that's in the press release, I didn't happen to stumble upon it in my reading of the book or my skimming of the book, but apparently you said, both political sides take a problem and do two things with it. Mm-hmm. First, they try to make us afraid of it, and second, they blame it on the other side. What they don't do is work together to confront the underlying causes of our problems and solve them. And certainly we see how difficult that is. Do you say that the liberals or the Democrats do that like the Republicans and the conservatives do, and would you give an example?
Well, you know, let me start. That's a great question. I'll start by saying I wrote this book on a sabbatical, and so I withdrew from engagement with the political process and the news cycle for about 3 months. But I'd watch the news cycle every night. I'm writing and working and studying all day, but then I'd watch the cycle, and it was depressing. The kind of the vitriol, the hatred in the media and politics back. I think both sides do the blame thing, not the governing thing. And it's become, if you flip the channels at night, the politics are different, but you see some of the same tone. And I think we've got to find some way to get to what the heart of the issue is. How do you solve a problem? What's right and what works is more important than what's left and what's right. And how do we kind of transcend the political battle? What I learned on this sabbatical is we've lost this ancient idea called the common good. It's in all of our traditions, religious and secular. And it says it can't just be myself and my group and my party that has to win. It's got to be all of us. I mean, Jesus' notion, Jewish law, you love your neighbor as yourself. As simple as that is in the day after Easter, it's foundational for the common good. All of our neighbors have to be part of the conversation here. And so I think both sides have some things to learn there.
George in Brooklyn, you're on WNYC. Hi, George.
Hi. Thanks for taking the call. Let's see. The simplest way to say it is, why does this man think that his morality is superior to the people who think that dinosaurs lived 6,000 years ago? I mean, it's the same book they're basing it on, and everybody thinks is going gaga about it. It's silly.
In other words, why base morality on religion or belief in God or the Bible?
Yes, I mean, they're hooking it all up. I mean, the president gets on all the time and says, we are our brother's keeper. Well, that's what, I mean, he doesn't even know the Bible correctly, because Cain was the person who said that. He killed his brother. Right. But he said it as a sort of smart alky thing.
George, thank you. And as you know, Reverend Wallace, there is a growing, active atheist movement. This is another group that's coming out of the closet in America, I would say since 9/11, and saying, look, I don't care whether it's, you know, Christianity or what people do in the name of the Quran, some people, or whatever, we need to stop taking morality from these works or these institutions that also drive us to such murderous excess. Mm-hmm. We all know what right and wrong are because they're universal. And they don't derive from any of these religions, so why even go there?
Good question. First of all, let me be clear. Religion has no monopoly on morality. Say it again. Religion has no monopoly on morality. Dr. King never said that he got to win because he was a Christian in a Judeo-Christian country. He never said that. He said, I have to win the debate about what's best for the common good, not just for Baptists and for Jews, but for all of us, that we need a Civil Rights Act and a Voting Rights Act for the common good. So in the book, I talk about how the common good, this wonderful ancient, it goes back centuries, is rooted in all of our faith traditions, but also in our democratic secular traditions. And so I want to help spark a debate about the common good. I don't care if people come at it from a religious or a secular point of view. In fact, we're having a common good forum that's going to be open to all views. In fact, I'll just say, if you want to be a part of it, just text, it's just good, G-O-O-D, good, 877-877, good, 877-877, and we're taking all kinds of points of view. The prerequisite to getting to the right place is nobody imposing their morality, but having the right framework. The framework is what's best for all of us for the common good.
We have a few minutes left. I want to touch on a couple of other things real quick. One, you're an evangelical. You describe yourself, right?
Small e.
Small e, progressive evangelical. Uh-huh. Do you have any thought about the new Catholic Pope? At least on first blush, it seems like Pope Francis is coming out with a little bit of what you're saying, which is that we have to look past the social issues. Not that he isn't very conservative on the social issues, he appears to be, but he seems to want to re-emphasize poverty.
He does. Simplicity is a part of what he's saying, which I think is a breath of fresh air. I think what he did on Maundy Thursday, where he had a service in a jail for juvenile inmates, and he actually included women in that too, and he washed the feet of men and women, in fact, most of whom were Muslim. Now, this kind of thing sends signals. What he does about women, my wife is a priest. She's a Church of England priest. This pope has to embrace women religious in the church have been really, mistreated by the Vatican. He has to turn that around. And so I think Cardinal Dolan the other day said, we have to reconnect Jesus and the church. It was a huge thing to say. Jesus and the church get unconnected. And many people, biggest segment now in the country growing is the unaffiliateds, the nuns. I love all the nuns, the nuns in the bus, N-U-N and the N-O-N, none of the above. But most of the none of the aboves, they're not atheists. They're just disenchanted with religion. And they kind of like Jesus. So the book is about what Jesus says and does as different from religion. And I think that really is a foundation for the common good. And that invites everybody into that conversation, whether they're religious or whether or not.
And just briefly, on one last topic, and another turn of the season in addition to spring and Easter, you come out in the book as a baseball fan and a Little League coach. So happy opening day.
Thank you.
And I just spent, as I mentioned earlier, last week on spring break with my wife and son in Florida, largely going to spring training games. You should do it if you never have before your kids are all grown up, for the intimacy of it, if nothing else, the small ballparks, the laid-back feel. Have you ever done it?
My kids right now are in the Dominican playing with Dominican kids, a baseball service project, baseball and literacy. And I would be there if I wasn't here every spring. And it is opening day. I got my team. We've done the draft. My son's team. We are so excited. I mean, this is we have a sign outside our house. This family has been interrupted by the baseball season. My wife's a commissioner. I'm a coach. All my kids play. And, to me, it's the common good. I learn lessons on the field about the common good. And your last caller really, really reminded me to say, this is a conversation open to everybody, not just the religious. If we don't get the common good, we're in trouble. So, again, if you want to be a part of the conversation for us, it's good, 877-877.
We share something that I don't know the race of your children, but my white son has played in an overwhelmingly Dominican youth league for the last three, four years. But they're learning each other. They're learning the common humanity.
It brings them together.
Through the baseball games.
They really are.
And it's really wonderful in that way. And by the way, if you ever go to spring training, I'll give you a little tip. Avoid the lemonade at the Tiger Stadium in Lakeland. It's all water and sugar. But the lemonade at the Philly Stadium in Clearwater, perfect.
Oh, my Tigers, my home team Tigers, bad, bad drinks.
That's not a Nationals fan? You lived in Washington for so long?
I grew up in Detroit. I'm both.
Cheap tickets for less than $30. I sat right behind home plate at the Astros Park in Kissimmee when they played the Nationals. Could see Washington's boy Bryce Harper get three hits from about 3 feet away.
Yeah.
So the spring training trip is, once you're down there, affordable. And
kids just come alive with Bay baseball. A kid got to second base, he started the rally, never got there before, international kid, had no clue about baseball, and he starts, his British kid, shaking the hand of the shortstop. I said, Stefan, get on second base. He said, oh, I've never been here before.
Jim Wallace, His new book is On God's Side, What Religion Forgets and Politics Hasn't Learned About Serving the Common Good. Thank you so much.
Great to be here.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC. Stay with us.